Hi, everyone. It's April Johnston, the host of Nebby. It has been a long while since I recorded a podcast, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity to tell this story and hopefully help find answers in this case. If you grew up in Western Pennsylvania in the 1980s, like I did, it will be a familiar one. I'm talking about the disappearance of Cherry Mahan. Cherry is the 8-year-old girl who stepped off the school bus onto Corn Planter Road in Butler County on February 22, 1985, and was never seen again. She was just steps from her parents' driveway, but she never made it to the house, and it was immediately clear to police that she hadn't left on her own. Cherry's school photograph was everywhere after that. The sweet elfin face framed by a lacy Peter Pan collar and roller straight bangs. It seemed impossible that someone so innocent, so small, could just be gone. Those of you who lived through this know how much it terrified parents. Cherry's the reason you couldn't walk to the bus stop alone, the reason they taught you about strangers and made you memorize safe words. They didn't want what happened to her to happen to you. Cherry's case went national when ADVO, the U.S. Postal Service, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children made her the very first child to appear in a Have You Seen Me ad. Today, that ongoing campaign is credited with helping to reunite nearly 150 missing kids with their families. But not Cherry. It's been more than 40 years now, and we don't know much more about her disappearance than the day it happened. She left no clues, no witnesses, no footprints. It's as if the earth opened up and swallowed her whole. Her mother, Janice McKinney, is still haunted by the events of that afternoon. Imagine going to sleep every night for 40 years. That's more than 14,000 nights not knowing where your child is. Worse, imagine waking up every morning and realizing it all over again. Late last year, as the 40th anniversary of Cherry's disappearance neared, Janice wondered how much longer she could do it. How much longer could she hound police for updates, post about it on her Facebook page, listen to questionable theories from strangers, and get nothing in return? Maybe it was healthier to let go.
I was ready to give up. I truly was. Because I've done everything that was humanly possible. I don't have a lot of money, so I couldn't do a lot of things. I was left to my own devices, and I just felt, you know, God said, I don't know what else to do for you.
One evening around that time, she went to dinner with friends, and in a rare display of hopelessness, she admitted that she probably had one more year left in her. One more year of searching for Cherry, and then she would have to move on. When the friends left her that night, they began talking. Janice had carried this burden by herself for too long. They vowed to help her.
Her hope has never wavered. And when we saw her that night, I saw it in her eyes that she wasn't kidding, that this was the, and it, to me, it sounded like just a cry for help.
This is Bailey Gazinski. She's the ringleader of the group Janice has dubbed Cherry's Angels. For the past 9 months, Bailey, her sisters Alyssa Dietz and Carly Gazinski, and her wife Tina Gazinski have thrown themselves into Cherry's case. They hosted a 40th anniversary event at a local fire hall, created a Facebook page dedicated to collecting new tips, and they've followed all the clues, even the ones that have taken them down some really twisted rabbit holes. As Bailey likes to say, They each have a 9-to-5 job and a 5-to-9 job. But all that work is paying off. They think they're close to an answer, maybe closer than Janice has ever been before. Which is why I created this podcast, Finding Cherry. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to take you through the case from the moment Cherry stepped off the bus to today. I'm laying out the last 40 years in one place and asking you to listen and then to share the podcast with everyone you know. Because you or they may have that last piece of information Janice and her angels need to finally bring Cherry home. The story begins in Saxonburg, Pennsylvania, a small rural community about 35 miles north of Pittsburgh. It's the 1960s, and Janice McKinney, Janice Mahan then, is just a kid living an innocent, pretty idyllic life, romping through the woods, wading across creeks, and building bonfires with her siblings and the neighbor kids.
Growing up in the 60s was amazing. I mean, you know, my parents owned a gas station. You know, we'd get free ice cream and candy, and my grandmother lived behind us, and, you know, we had a swimming pool. If we didn't swim in our pool, we went through the field and swam at the neighbor's. So back in those days, it was amazing.
But just as her adulthood would be, Janice's childhood was split into a before and an after. When Janice was still in elementary school, her older brother, David, died. He was only 16, and it changed everything. Shortly after David's death, their dad, Alvin, had a massive heart attack that forced him to sell the gas station. Without that steady income, the family couldn't afford their home, so they moved in with Janice's grandmother. If every day before David's death had bubbled with possibility, every day after came smudged with grief.
It just changed. Our life changed. And it wasn't the same anymore. When I was 16, well, when I was 15, I was trying to be something that I was not. And I got pregnant and had Cherry. I had Cherry when I turned 16, July 24th, and August 14th, I had Cherry.
A teenage pregnancy wasn't ideal, of course, but Cherry's arrival in the summer of 1976 brought joy back into a house that desperately needed it. Thanks to the long hours he kept at the gas station, Alvin had missed a lot of milestones with his own kids. Cherry gave him a second chance. When Janice returned to school that fall, it was Alvin who took care of Cherry.
Him and Cherry, every morning, you'd see my dad walk up through the apple orchard and Cherry would be following behind him, walking with her hands behind her back, just like my dad did. It was just, it was amazing. Like, for Christmas one year, he sat down and popped popcorn and threaded it on a string for her to put it on the tree. Like, he never had time for us. So it was amazing. I think God gave me Cherry for that reason.
When she wasn't with Alvin, Cherry spent much of her time with her grandmother, Shirley. Shirley was the town tax collector, and Cherry often accompanied her to the office. Even when they promised they were just taking a quick trip into town or only going to check the mail, Janice said they'd often be gone all day, chatting up every neighbor and stranger they saw along the way. And then, at the dinner table at night, Cherry would recall every encounter in excruciating detail. Some nights, Alvin turned down his hearing aids so he could get a little peace when he ate. On Sundays, the entire Mahan family would head over to Saxonburg Memorial Church, where Shirley sang in the choir. It was Cherry's favorite family ritual.
She couldn't wait to go to church. And she'd run down that ramp, and she just loved Jesus. And, you know, I sometimes was a little late, and I'd be late getting to church. And then she'd be mad because everybody'd be in church, and my mom always sang in the choir, and that just made Cherry mad because usually we'd be early and she could go up there and sit with my mom. Well, if I was late, and we'd have to sit in the back, Cherry'd be so mad she'd just get down on the floor, crawl underneath all the pews, cling to the front, get out, walk up there while the preacher's preaching and sit down with my mom. She did that all the time.
Though Janice hated to separate grandmother and granddaughter, she and Cherry finally moved out of Shirley's house shortly after Alvin died. Looking back on it today, Janice calls it a blessing. Alvin never had to live with Cherry's disappearance. The reason for the move? Janice had met and married a man named Leroy McKinney, a Vietnam veteran who loved to fish. Together, they'd saved up enough money to buy that plot of land on Corn Planter Road, only about 15 minutes from Shirley's house. It seemed like the perfect place to plant their trailer, an area with wide stretches of open land between pockets of dense woods. They imagined Cherry exploring that land with friends. Instead, the seclusion seemed to scare her. The trailer was situated so that Leroy and Janice slept at the back. Cherry's room was at the front, closest to the driveway, and she was certain someone was sneaking onto the property after the sunset and peeking into her window. On some nights, she was so gripped by fear that she couldn't sleep. She'd lay on her bed with her dog, Scruffy, and a book, and she'd read and read until her eyelids got heavy. Maybe it was just the wild imagination of an 8-year-old, but Janice didn't want to take any chances. She moved Cherry out of the big bedroom at the front of the trailer and into a smaller bedroom toward the back, closer to her and Leroy. Whatever had spurred those fears, they seemed confined to the night. When the sun rose bright in the morning, Cherry shined with it. She chattered through breakfast and skipped to the school bus, a happy 8-year-old ready for another day. And really, that's what Cherry was, Janice says. A typical, happy 8-year-old kid. Her favorite color was purple. She wanted to be a teacher, trying out her lessons on the Cabbage Patch doll she named Katrina. She loved tuna fish sandwiches and books and Care Bears and Scruffy. Well, at least until Scruffy chewed the face off of said Care Bear. Janice had promised to go out and buy her daughter a new one, which was one of the reasons Cherry would have been anxious to get home on that afternoon of Friday, February 22nd, 1985. She knew the Care Bear would be waiting for her on her bed. The other reason? Janice was scheduled to work that night at St. Barnabas, a retirement and nursing home community where she served as the director of housekeeping. So Cherry was going to a friend's for a sleepover. It was just after 4 o'clock that afternoon when Janice and Leroy heard Cherry's bus pull up on Corn Planter Road. "You want me to get her?" Leroy asked his wife. Janice shook her head. It was almost 68 degrees that afternoon, practically balmy for winter in western Pennsylvania, and the snow that had blanketed their long, winding driveway had mostly melted in the sun. "Nah, let her walk," Janice replied. Actually, she figured Cherry was more likely to run the quarter mile to their house, given her excitement for the Care Bear and the sleepover. But after 5 minutes passed with no sign of Cherry, Janice and Leroy worried that maybe that melting snow had turned their driveway into a mess that Cherry couldn't navigate in her little beige ankle boots. Leroy went out to look for her, but he returned in what seemed like seconds. "She's not there," he said. Panic punched Janice in the chest. Cherry had never not come home. Together, she and Leroy ran outside, jumped into his truck, and tore down the driveway. No Cherry. They chased the bus along its usual route and ran to the door when it stopped. No Cherry. The bus driver said she'd gotten off at her stop, as always. So, back to Corn Planter Road, where a neighbor said she'd watched Cherry hop off the bus and start around the short bend to the McKinney's driveway, just as she was turning her car into her own driveway. But still, no Cherry.
And at that point, it's like Cherry fell into a black hole and disappeared.
So Janice picked up the phone to make two tearful calls. One to her mother, Shirley, and one to the police. The call came into the state police barracks in Butler at 5:20 p.m. An 8-year-old girl named Cherry Mahan got off the bus in Winfield Township and never made it home. She was 4 feet 2 inches tall, weighed 68 pounds, and was last seen wearing a gray coat, a denim skirt, blue leg warmers, beige ankle boots, and cabbage patch earmuffs. As daylight waned, more than 100 people scoured the woods around the McKinney trailer for any sign of Cherry. Firefighters set up roadblocks to stop passing cars and alert motorists to a missing child. Volunteers with bloodhounds attempted to follow Cherry's scent. And police tracked down the school bus driver and the passengers to see if they could remember anything important or unusual from that afternoon. A few of the 30-some children on the bus reported that a strange van had been following them along their route. It was blue, with portal-like windows, kind of like a boat, and it had a scene of a skier riding down a snow-capped mountain painted across its side. The neighbor, who just an hour or so earlier told Janice and Leroy she'd seen Cherry get off the bus, confirmed that she too had seen that van. Police had their first lead. By the next day, a sketch of the van with its mountain scene was all over the news. And hopes were high. It shouldn't be difficult to spot something so distinctive. A police helicopter took off to search the area from above, and volunteers fanned out across town, carrying photos of Cherry. Meanwhile, Janice, Leroy, and Shirley spoke with newspaper reporters and appeared on television, tearfully begging for anyone with information to contact police. Neighbors started a fund to raise reward money, and by March 28th, a month after Cherry's disappearance, the fund totaled more than $35,000. But clues? They were still nearly non-existent. State Trooper Glenn Hall served as the lead investigator of Cherry's case back in 1985 and would work it until his retirement in 1993. He'd grown up in Butler County, joined the military to serve a stint in Vietnam, and then returned home to a career in law enforcement. He knew the area well, and he knew most everyone who lived in it, including the Mahan family. In fact, he kept in regular touch with Shirley for many years, even after he retired. This case was his white whale, and the family came to appreciate his dedication to it. But in those early days of the investigation, Janice and Leroy found themselves frustrated by what they viewed as Hall's tunnel vision. Anyone who listens to crime podcasts or watches crime television shows knows the investigator's blueprint. Start with those closest to the victim. For Hall, questioning Leroy not only seemed like good investigative practice, it also seemed like an avenue that could lead somewhere. Remember, Hall knew most everyone in town, and that included Leroy. In fact, Hall recalled the night Leroy drove his car into the local VFW. He was either drunk or high. It's how he spent a lot of nights after he returned from Vietnam. It was the only way he knew to numb the pain, Janice says. But Hall didn't seem to understand Leroy's behavior. He'd served in Vietnam too, and he didn't have PTSD. He didn't drink and drive and run cars into buildings. And if Leroy McKinney were capable of that, Hall began to wonder what else he might be capable of. Janice knew better.
When Leroy and I got together, it was hard on all of us because Cheery and I were together all the time. And it was like we were sisters, not mom and daughter. And then you throw Leroy in the mix and it's like Cheery wanted me to do this, Leroy wanted me to do that. So I'm getting pulled. And it was hard at first. It really was. And it was hard on Leroy because he was a Vietnam veteran. PTSD was hard on him. And there was a few times that we got into some battles.
But the little blended family had turned a corner. In 1984, just before Thanksgiving, Cheery had gone to stay with some friends for a few days. On their way back to Butler to drop Cheery off, an ambulance hit their car head-on. Cheery ended up at a hospital in Natrona Heights with a broken collarbone. Police called Janice at work, and she left immediately, speeding the entire 20 miles. When she finally arrived at Cherry's bedside, her daughter frowned. "I told them to call my dad, not you," she said. Instead of being hurt at her daughter's reaction, Janice just smiled. She took it as a sign of the growing bond between Cheery and Leroy. There was no way he'd done anything to hurt his stepdaughter. To prove Leroy's innocence, both he and Janice agreed to take lie detector tests. They passed. Those results eventually convinced Trooper Hall, but they couldn't stop the whispers that had started in town. With no sign of Cheery or that suspicious van, some began to suspect Janice and Leroy, even if there was no proof. Maybe it was a misguided attempt at comfort. If Janice and Leroy had done it, there wasn't a kidnapper on the loose. The most awful rumor started close to home, with Shirley's neighbors. They whispered that Cherry's biological father, a man who denied paternity and had been completely absent from Cherry's life, drafted Leroy into a scheme that resulted in the pair selling Cheery for drugs. That rumor, the accusations, living without knowing what happened to her daughter, it was all too much. And it broke Janice. She began looking for a way, any way, to escape the pain.
I have a 36-year-old son now. And he got into drugs. And he always used to say to me, "You don't understand." I said, "Let me explain this to you. I do understand. Because I did a lot of drugs when Cheery was first kidnapped because that pain was horrible. It was so... It was just so... Like, people were just pulling me every which way. And I couldn't understand. And I couldn't understand why her and why me... Because it was horrible. That pain, like I said, I've lost my dad, my mom. I've worked in a nursing home for 40 years. I know when I see, you know, death is a part of life. And I understand that, but this... I couldn't understand. I just could not. Especially, she had so much life to live. And it was hard. That was so hard. And probably for 6 months, if I just did something because I didn't want to hurt anymore, because that was horrible. And then it wasn't helping. So I just did quit. And... didn't take the pain away, but I kind of understood the pain then.
But understanding the pain didn't make it easier to live with. Not then, and not over the past 40 years. What you need to understand about Janice is that she's a caretaker. She'll gladly take on anyone's burden as long as they feel just a little bit lighter. She helped care for her parents before they died. She cared for Leroy for most of his life and helped nurse him before his early death in 2018. Today, she still cares for her sister-in-law. She's a loud, infectious laugh and a way of making people feel comfortable in her presence. But she also wears her pain. It's with her always. Given everything Janice has been through and everything she's done for others, Bailey, Alyssa, Carly, and Tina just couldn't bear to sit back and watch her pain any longer.
At this point, I'm sick of patience. You know, I want Janice to get that answer. I want her to live the rest of her life knowing where, you know, what happened to her daughter and who did it and where she's at, and just to know that she's okay. And I love you, Janice, but I won't be patient. We're not going to be patient anymore.
Next week, in episode 2, I'll introduce you to Cherry's Angels and the lengths to which they've gone to try to find some peace for this woman they consider their family. When I began reporting this story many months ago, I promised Janice that I would release the first episode on August 14th for a very special reason. It's Cherry's birthday. Happy birthday, Cherry. Many thanks to Janice, Bailey, Alyssa, Carly, and Tina, who gave hours of their time to help me get this story right. Also, thanks to Joey Smith for cover art and David Smith for production help. Please see the show notes for more source information and music credits. And please, please share this podcast with everyone you know. The only way Janice will find Cherry is if someone comes forward with more information. You could be that someone. See you next week.